Welcome to the KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. In this episode, we have stories on science behind last week's Mendocino earthquake and a community forest project nearing completion. But first, some local updates and alerts, including on Miranda's rescue. This is KMUD News. Starting off with an alert from CAL FIRE in southern Humboldt. There will be a professionally controlled burn of invasive barbed goat grass in the Ettersburg area near Wilder Ridge Road and French Ranch Road tomorrow, Tuesday, June 30th. These burns are part of a prescribed fire program for vegetative management and hazardous fire fuels reduction. This treatment will help to enhance the health of the native plant communities, aid in the control of non-native plant species, protect and enhance prairie habitat for animal species, and aid in the reduction and control of uncontrolled wildfire. The controlled burn is weather permitting. Also in southern Humboldt, in the Stafford area. Yesterday, Sunday, June 29th, there was a shelter-in-place order in Stafford due to an armed and barricaded suspect. 41-year-old Kenneth Poland was arrested after many hours of negotiation with law enforcement during an armed standoff. SWAT resources were allocated to the scene, and according to scanner traffic, police established a perimeter around the residence at the 400 block of North Road. Kenneth Poland was eventually apprehended and taken into custody without further incident. The same residence had been searched in 2021 by the Humboldt County Drug Task Force while serving a warrant for drug-related charges. At that time, the task force arrested Poland and another individual for suspicion of possession of controlled substances for sale, possession of methamphetamine for sale, and operating or maintaining a drug house. We'll update our listeners as we learn more about the circumstances leading to yesterday's shelter-in-place order. And the Humboldt Sheriff's Office has identified Kenneth Poland as an armed violent felony suspect. Also involving the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff William Hansel held a press conference today, June 29th, on the continued investigation into Miranda's rescue. Here are some highlights from the sheriff's remarks today.
June 23rd, 2026, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office Major Crimes Division completed a second search warrant. Operation and follow-up investigation at Miranda's rescue. That search warrant authorized the Sheriff's Office to search the grounds, buildings associated with Miranda's rescue for evidence related to animal cruelty and fraud. This included the excavation of open fields for evidence for deceased dogs believed to be buried in mass graves. During the excavation, investigators uncovered 117 intact canine remains from two separate dig sites. There were two holes, distinct holes. We excavated 117 dogs out of those two holes. The deepest was about 12 to 15 feet deep. The dogs were layered. You can tell that there was different times that the various dogs were put in. And according to our timeline through evidence, it was determined that the dogs were buried here sometime after January. Between January and April 2026. 70 of the dogs were x-rayed on site, and many of those dogs showed evidence of bullet fragments. In total, 91 microchips were recovered from the scene. Six were recovered from the loose dirt area where the bones were discovered. That's where the 29 canine skulls and hundreds of dog bones were discovered. The six loose microchips were also discovered in there. And 85 of the microchips were scanned from those 117 intact dogs. Many of those microchips trace back to shelters and rescue facilities throughout the state. I have our analysts currently working and reviewing that data obtained by those microchips, and we're working to link up our investigators with those previous owners of those dogs.
And is there any update on the kind of charity aspect of this? Like, have there been violations of the nonprofit status by Shannon Miranda? Like, what is that aspect of the kind of more paperwork side of the investigation?
So this is still an active fraud investigation as well. We're looking at all aspects of this case to determine what applicable laws could have been broken. It is going to be up to our investigation team to review all those different records, and then at the conclusion of the investigation, present that evidence to our prosecution team to see if there's any violation of the law.
Is Shannon Miranda required to check in with the sheriff's office? Are his movements restricted in any way at this time?
Not at all. He is a free citizen, free to move, and he's voluntarily checking in with our people 3 days a week.
You stated that you've dug in two spots on that area. Are you planning on digging in other locations, or are you done?
So we spent 3 days looking there, and as we go back, so on this parcel, so what we did is we excavated in various locations of this parcel, and we dug basic potholes, essentially, looking for when there was anomalies in the soil, we dug in those areas. And there was a couple different spots where we found bones in different areas of this property. Other spots where we found more mass grave, but the animals were in advanced stages of decomposition. And at that point in time, it didn't serve any evidentiary value to remove those animals from that location, because essentially we couldn't make a determination at that point in time, based upon the severe decomposition of those animals. That location was on the north end of the property, in this little area right here. So at this point in time, we don't have any plans to returning to the property, but that could change if evidence, if there's something that, comes forward, we could ask the judge for another search warrant and go out there to excavate. We were there again for 3 days. We had experts there for 3 days performing a lot of intense work. Like I said, this was a pretty horrific situation, and our people and everyone involved did some tremendous work working around these conditions.
And in terms of the microchip process of identifying the animals and then potentially connecting them with people, community members who have said that they surrendered dogs there, is that part of the process you're currently involved in, or will you kind of hold off on that until the investigation is further along?
So that is going to be the next stage in the investigation, is we're going to try and link up the microchip data with the previous owners, with our investigators. So over the next week or two, people that do have animals that were transferred to Miranda's Rescue in the past year could be receiving a phone call from us. And so at that point in time, we'll be asking some specific questions surrounding that adoption.
I was wondering if you could speak any more to the bar and kill zone and what that looked like. Where did you find the 600 callers? Were they all together? Were there name tags? Why do you think he might have kept them?
So I'm not going to speculate as far as why I think he kept them, but this is the barn facility where the callers were located. This is the barn where he supposedly has quarantined the animals that were coming onto his rescue. And this is also the area where we have evidence to show that the euthanasia occurred. We found spent shell casings. We found 22 rounds, as well as the 22 rifle was also located there, as well as blood spatter, and the collars were located at that location.
Could the investigation lead to looking into whether the shelters that sent the dogs to the rescue knew about the alleged activity happening there?
That's going to be a part of our investigation. We want to know what the expectation was for the people sending the dogs to Miranda's Rescue. That's going to be very important for us to know what the expectation was, what the MOUs, what the contracts state. Many of these larger agencies do have contracts that say some specific things about how the animals should be cared for. And so we will be looking at that, but there's also going to be agreements, handshakes. There's going to be emails, conversations that people had that are pertinent to this case.
Can you speak to the complexity of charging someone for killing dogs?
I mean, this is a case that's, has brought a lot of shock to some people, because people say, you shouldn't be allowed to shoot a dog. And the state law says you can shoot a dog, right? And you just can't do it in a malicious manner. That's what the law says.
And so, you know, generally malicious, you know, means in the law that we have to prove is that they intentionally did the wrongful acts or acted with an unlawful intent to disturb, defraud, annoy, or injure someone else, okay? That's malicious when it comes to the law in 597, animal cruelty here in California. So we have to prove whether or not someone tortured, wounded, or killed a living animal, and the defendant acted maliciously and intentionally. So those are the rules. So those are the things that we have to prove animal cruelty charges. So shooting an animal in and of itself is not animal cruelty.
So critics of Shannon Miranda have said for years that they've sent complaints to the sheriff, but nothing was done. Can you explain why it takes so long to pursue a criminal investigation?
Sure, there could be allegations about someone you know, being made, but without concrete evidence, we cannot act on those things. It's one of the things that I mentioned from the very beginning, is that there's a lot of rumors, a lot of speculation, and so when people provide that information to the sheriff's office, we have to ask, what evidence do you have that proves that allegation? And so that's what we have to act on. We have to act on evidence. We have to act on firsthand knowledge, something witnessed. And so we are moving through a lot of the previous complaints that have been made to assure that there weren't things that we missed, things that's you know, hadn't been previously investigated, or maybe there's an allegation that they didn't have evidence to prove at the time that may be very relevant here today. And so we are contacting those previous people and seeing what they know and seeing how it links up with our current investigation.
That was audio from today's press conference with Sheriff William Hansel on the Miranda's rescue investigation. We'll keep the updates coming as the Miranda's rescue situation and investigation continues. And now to our main stories. This is KMUD News. A Southern Humboldt Community Forest project that has been in the works for 10 years is nearing completion. Daniel Mintz reports.
The Sanctuary Forest Land and Water Trust is advancing toward completion of one of its most ambitious projects, the creation of Van Auken Creek Community Forest. Sanctuary Forest Executive Director April Newlander gave an update on the Conservation, Restoration, and Public Access Project during a June 24th online presentation to the Community Economic Resilience Consortium. Beginning in 2016 with fundraising, followed by land and conservation easement purchases in the Whitethorn area, the project has proceeded with restoration, including in-stream habitat restoration. Newlander said the impetus for the conservation effort was to head off a timber harvest plan and potential subdivision.
It was definitely a bit of an urgency. There was actually 300 acres approved on a timber harvest plan for clear cuts. And so we were really concerned. We didn't want to see that happening. And then this map shows all the different subdivision that was potentially could occur as well. It had 24 different legal parcels that could have been divided up. And this is a watershed that's already has insufficient water supply. So we really felt strongly we wanted to keep this all in one piece. You know, there's this surrounded by residential, you know, the community does live. This is kind of like in Whitethorn, kind of downtown. So it's, we've got a lot of community around it, but we felt really important that we needed to prevent further clear cuts and development and wanted to keep this all into one piece.
An initial challenge was meeting the land buy's $9 million cost. A fundraising campaign saw unprecedented success, raising over $700,000. That initial success got the attention of state agencies, leading to a number of grants, including those from the state's Department of Water Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Proposition 68. The land purchase was made by Lost Coast Forest Lands, which then sold a 300-acre conservation easement to Sanctuary Forest with conditions related to sustainable forestry, restoration, and public access. To create water sources during low-flow periods, Sanctuary Forest has developed 7 off-channel ponds that pump water to augment stream flows.
We've built 7 ponds total in the headwaters, and Van Auken, just this last summer, we built two ponds that total almost 8 million gallons of water. This is a drone shot of one of the ponds. And these ponds, the idea with these ponds is they're not connected to the creek. They're off channel, but we're actually using them to augment stream flow. So these have pumps. We're going to be pumping the water out of the pond. They go up to tanks, and then they go into an infiltration gallery, and that goes into the stream. And so what we're going to be doing is we start doing that when the flows get low and we have baby fish that need to have pools because the coho need to survive a whole summer in the headwaters before they can go out to the ocean. So it's a very hands-on approach. It's a newer, we keep refining our methods as we learn more. And this is our most recent pond that we have installed. And it's really beautiful right now. It's with the water, it just looks really inviting. It's really nice.
The project has a public access element with 25 miles of trails possible, including an ADA accessible trail encircling one of the ponds. The Community Economic Resilience Consortium, Networks Economic Progress, and Newlander talked about the community forest project's economic significance.
In 2025, we actually spent $3.7 million paid out to contractors and vendors, employed 10 local businesses. So we really are keeping the money locally. A lot of these grants were in this severely disadvantaged community, and they really want that the public funds to be supporting these disadvantaged communities. So we have 10 local businesses, and they hire all these local crews, and it's been really amazing. You know, we're kind of economically depressed right now, so to be able to provide jobs has been really important.
The project's near future restoration work includes in-stream habitat restoration of 4,000 feet of Van Auken Creek this summer, and the public access program is expected to begin in 2027. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Last week's earthquake in Mendocino jolted many residents, but we wanted to learn more about emerging local science to better predict and understand quakes in our area. KMUD News reports. Last week, on Wednesday, June 24th, Mendocino County experienced a 5.6 magnitude earthquake. That in itself is, of course, far from unusual. But many residents, particularly in the Willits area, felt a strong jolt that set off car alarms and caused items to fall from walls and shelves in many homes. KMUD News wanted to learn more about this specific quake, along with the latest science on earthquake detection, and how the latest local science on earthquakes might better inform and warn the public during future earthquake events. We turned to two experts. Dr. Eric Riggs, Dean of the Cal Poly Humboldt College of Natural Resources and Sciences, and Dr. Jason Patton, an engineering geologist with the California Department of Conservation. Both are preeminent experts in the science of earthquakes, but more importantly, both experts we interviewed are working on current earthquake science that could have direct impacts for residents of our region. Dr. Jason Patton is part of a team that recently discovered a new fault line in southern Humboldt, and Dr. Eric Riggs is involved with research utilizing existing fiber optic cable installations as a new way to detect earthquakes. We'll first hear from Dr. Eric Riggs, who gave some insight into the latest major Mendocino earthquake and why those in the Willits area specifically felt the most notable impacts.
I mean, there's two pieces really to look for. There's the source, the earthquake itself, and then there's the site response, how the ground moves in response to the earthquake. So faults in that area, it looks like reading the data that is published by the U.S. Geological Survey Earthquake Hazards Program about that earthquake, it looks like it was a right lateral earthquake where if you were standing on one side of the fault and you looked across the fault, if you could watch that move, it would have moved to the right. And so that generates energy that is directed, in this case, sort of southeast partially and northwest and so from where the earthquake source is. And so Willits may have been sort of in the direction of motion and might have gotten an extra blast that way. Something similar happened with the earthquake a couple years ago in December that impacted Rio Del very intensely, but left Ferndale much less damaged. And that was really similar. You had some directivity to how the earthquake moved in the first place. I mean, it's a slippage of two rock masses sliding past each other. And so, you know, just like any kind of system that generates some inertia, you're gonna throw some energy in one direction preferentially over another, and that can impact anybody in the way. So that may have been a factor. The other factor that you have to layer in here is the actual situation of the town of Willits in the Willits Basin. There's a little flat basin there that is surrounded by hills everywhere, and so there's probably some sediment from the hills that has filled in that basin over time, and then the town is built on top of it. And that kind of sediment, you know, can also trap water, is a little bit local groundwater and things, and it, from a seismic perspective, is pretty jiggly.
Dr. Eric Riggs of Cal Poly Humboldt then spoke of ongoing research into utilizing fiber optic cable systems as additional earthquake sensors, and how this could greatly benefit areas like California's North Coast that may not offer the same earthquake sensor coverage as other regions.
So if you think about what a fiber optic cable is, it's a bundle of very optically clear glass fibers along which you pass optical pulses, usually driven by lasers, and that carries information, carries voice, carries internet, at videos, banking information, you name it, right? Travels that way. And that's how the vast majority of data is transmitted around the planet long distance these days. The cool thing about that is if you leave one or two of those strands dark, you mean you don't put any data on that, it's just the strand itself, then you can instead use that strand to shoot just a single dedicated laser down that and have a detector at the other end of a segment. And using, you know, travel time, you can very accurately measure the length of that particular piece of cable. The reason that that matters from an earthquake perspective is if you think about what an earthquake wave is, I mean, it's a pulse of acoustic energy moving through the ground. I mean, it's a flexure, a very small one in, you know, an elastic wave basically running through the rock material. And so anything embedded in the ground, like a cable, will also flex and change shape and length very subtly, but certainly subtly enough to be picked up by, enough distortion to be picked up very easily by a laser, and the interference patterns based on what you'd expect, this is what you get. And so scientists and seismologists have been working to decode that information and convert that into an understanding of what the seismic waves are doing. And as this technology has come into being really over the last, you know, probably 10 years, experimentally 5 years being deployed more, and then over the last couple of years here, it's really exciting because you start to see these fiber optic installations make tremendous seismometers in places where you never had them before. The cool thing about the fiber optic cables is that instead of just getting that one singular point's worth of information, you actually can watch the seismic wave interacting with this entire line of the seismic cable of the fiber optic cable. And so that gives you a really different kind of longitudinal information about, you can watch the seismic wave unfold and see how it's moving and evolving as it travels. And so seismologists, people who are really deep into understanding these waveforms, are just, you know, thrilled by the richness of data they can extract from this. And fiber optic cables are going in everywhere, right? And so it's an opportunity to extend seismic networks in places where we hadn't had them before.
That was Dr. Eric Riggs on exciting new research into utilizing fiber optic cable networks as additional earthquake sensors. Next, we'll turn to Dr. Jason Patton, an engineering geologist with the California Department of Conservation, who helped spearhead a team that recently discovered a new fault line in southern Humboldt in the Shively area. Using geodesy, the study of how the Earth deforms and changes over time, Dr. Patton was able to utilize existing knowledge of fault lines and topographic maps to find evidence of the new fault in the form of an escarpment. Dr. Jason Patton then applied for funding from the USGS Earthquake Hazards Program with collaborator Mark Hemphill Haley, an emeritus professor from Cal Poly Humboldt. They have since excavated a line perpendicular to the suspected fault and confirmed Dr. Jason Patton's theory of an existing fault line. Dr. Patton spoke to KMUD News on the geological importance and history of the newly discovered fault, along with its relationship to other earthquake fault lines in the region.
In this location, on one side of the fault, the terrace is about 8 meters or 8 yards higher than the terrace on the other side of the fault. So that terrace has been lifted up due to, we think, four earthquakes have pushed that terrace up 8 meters. And so once we know when those earthquakes happen, we can calculate basically how much the fault slips during each earthquake and the average time between earthquakes. And we do have an estimate. We think this terrace is about 20,000 years. And so we think we have evidence for four earthquakes in the last 20,000 years. The San Andreas Fault south of us, that's the plate boundary fault between the North America plate on the east and the Pacific plate on the west. And that fault has sibling faults that run parallel to it. There's the Myokama Fault and the Bartlett Springs Fault. These are other faults to the east of the San Andreas Fault. And so the San Andreas Fault, it accommodates a portion of the plate boundary motion. But some of that plate boundary motion is also accommodated on the sibling faults. And so the plate boundary, the San Andreas plate boundary, even though the fault stops just north of Shelter Cove, the plate boundary motion extends further north into the Humble Bay region and past the Humble Bay region. And we think that some of those strike slip faults and at these east-west, so those are north-south oriented faults. And we think that that plate boundary motion ends along these east-west trending faults through compression and convergence and forming these thrust faults. And so this is one of those east-west trending faults that is accommodating that north-south compression from the San Andreas. And it looks like that it represents about one-fourth of the known faults north-south compression in the region. So it looks like it's the second most important fault after the Little Salmon Fault in the region.
That was Dr. Jason Patton on the newly discovered earthquake fault in the Shively area of southern Humboldt. The 5.6 magnitude earthquake in Mendocino last week was a good reminder of why the science behind earthquakes is important. Many residents received an alert to their phones during or just before the earthquake, and this ability to alert the public is in great part due to generations of geological research. Whether it's the potential to improve earthquake sensor networks via fiber optic cables or discovering exactly where our local fault lines are, this science helps us to understand why it's important to stay ready and prepared for future earthquakes. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Biana Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporter for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz. KMUD News is now on streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmod.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located in the unceded territory of the Sikyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.